This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we talk with a cancer survivor about his struggles with a fast-growing and disfiguring cancer. In the mid-1980s, Terry Healy was a handsome, athletic college student, the president of his fraternity. But with the discovery of a tumor, Healy became engaged in a battle for his life. That fight won. He had to confront the psychological impact of a facial disfigurement that destroyed much of the right side of his face. Even with extensive reconstructive surgery, Healy bears the scars of his fight with cancer. Terry Healy is our guest this afternoon. He's written a book about his experiences. Its title, At Face Value, My Struggle with a Disfiguring Cancer. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Terry Healy is a partner in a high-tech marketing and business development consulting firm. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with his wife. Again, our telephone number is 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Terry Healy, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Celeste.
When and how did you realize there was something wrong?
You know, quite honestly, I was 21 years old. I was somewhat oblivious to what was going on, and it took two people's comments to me, one a very close friend and one my brother, who at that point I wasn't seeing that frequently because we lived in different areas. But it took two people to approach me and say, you know, Terry, your nostril just looks different. It looks like it's flared out on the right side. And believe it or not, I hadn't noticed it myself. I went to the mirror when my brother said that to me, and I looked and I thought, yeah, it is. It does look a little different. But I quickly brushed it off and thought nothing about it. Really, the point at which I realized that I needed to go see somebody was when I picked up my University of California student ID card, and I looked at the photograph and I said, God, my right nostril really is flared out. And I couldn't believe that I hadn't noticed it before. I took a photograph to really make it apparent that there was something going on. So it was at that point that I finally went to a doctor.
Yeah, and he wasn't particularly worried either, was he?
No, I'll say. He it was somewhat of a humiliating experience because he suggested right away that it was a pimple and that probably the best form of treatment would be hot compresses, and he gave me some Drixerol. Now, being a 21-year-old at that time, I had had plenty of pimples, and I must say that I knew pretty much how they behaved, and I said, you know, I really don't think that's what this is, but who was I to question a doctor, a specialist for that matter? And so he told me to come back in 3 or 4 weeks if things hadn't changed. And so that's ultimately what happened.
And then there was a biopsy and a surgery.
There was a biopsy. And interestingly, Celeste, it took 5 weeks to get the results of the biopsy. So, you know, a lot of people would say, you know, how did you react to being told you had cancer at this young age? And, I was shocked when I got the final diagnosis 5 weeks later, but I think because it took so long to get that diagnosis the entire time, each day that ticked by, you started thinking, you know, more and more negative thoughts because typically these things don't take that long. And the reason it took so long was that it had to be sent to several different pathology places around the country. It ultimately ended up in Washington, D.C. before they actually could determine the type of cancer, and that's because it was a very rare form of cancer called a fibrosarcoma. And I think part of the problem was that fibrosarcomas typically don't occur in the head and neck. Mm-hmm. They typically occur in the lower extremities, the legs and such. So it was just a very odd type of a cancer.
Yeah. So there was the biopsy, and it took a little while for the diagnosis, and then there was a surgery, and then it seemed like everything was normal again for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But a year afterwards, there was another tumor, and that's when things really start to get really scary.
Yes. It was Yeah, right when I was starting my senior year in school, and it was right before midterms, and I started feeling this these tingling sensations in my face, which were definitely new, and I could feel a mass forming. Now, I had been to the doctor regularly. Oftentimes, they thought, okay, you could have scar tissue buildup, and so there really wasn't a lot of concern about it until I went to the doctor, and he said, oh, my God, you know, we've got something here that more than likely is a recurrence. So what started as this tiny little cancer that was very treatable only by surgery actually, became this horrendous, potentially life-threatening and disfiguring form of cancer that necessitated really extensive surgery and radiation to treat.
Yeah. I looked up this type of cancer on the internet, and as you've said and as you note in the book, it's very rare to see it on the face. And because of the type of cancer it is and where it was on your body, it was very difficult to treat. How was the course of treatment chosen?
Well, because it was complex in the fact that fibrosarcomas tend to grow in bone and muscle and the connective tissue. What that means is that it wasn't just within my tissue, but it had now, the likelihood was that it was in my bone and muscle. So suddenly you're faced with a very complex procedure to remove the tumor. So what they did is they brought me into a tumor board where specialists, probably about 15 specialists, would meet and discuss the difficult cases. It turned out mine was, I guess, the most difficult case that particular week, so they spent most of the time on my case. But, you know, I recount in the book this whole ordeal of living through this tumor board, which was an incredible experience in itself because it was very telling in terms of the opinions that were being formed as they examined me. And it was very upsetting in that I wasn't being treated like a person, but really as a lab specimen is what I felt like. So it really took a number of specialists to sit down in a conference room, talk through my case. Interestingly, though, Celeste, I've talked to my surgeon since. Now, I didn't know this at the time, but apparently the consensus was that this is not treatable. This has reached a stage that is it's not treatable anymore through surgery, radiation. It's just gone too far. My doctor, my oncologist, went out on a limb and said, you know, I am not going to allow that to happen. You know, this is a young guy who wants to live. And so, you know, I credit him a great deal for a lot of things, but most notably that he was able to get the support in the room to say, okay, go ahead and go forward and treat it as aggressively as you need to. And it's very difficult to hear what the prognosis was and what the form of treatment was going to be, to hear that, you know, suddenly I was going to lose half my nose, I was going to lose potentially my eye, I was going to lose muscle and bone in my cheek, and it just seemed like the end wasn't going to stop. And ultimately, the surgery revealed that the cancer had spread even further than that, and so I lost six of my teeth and part of my hard palate. But what was really fortunate was they were able to save my eye. I did lose the shelf of my eye, which created a lot of disfigurement, but the vision was never really impaired by it. So, you know, really my story, as you said earlier, became more about the aftermath of cancer mm-hmm. rather than the cancer itself. That was a much more difficult process for me to endure.
Eventually you discovered you had a lot of inner strength, thanks very much in part to the love and support of family and friends and your fraternity brothers. But there were so many challenges to face in the aftermath. I'm wondering if you would talk with us, please, about where one begins to face that kind of a struggle. What do you call on, you know, how do you get up every day?
Well, it's an interesting question because you don't really realize the severity of it until events start happening in your life, and encounters with people begin to happen in different ways. And so for me, you know, I felt very protected and insulated in the hospital environment. Medical professionals are used to seeing some pretty horrific things. And so they treated me like I was just a regular guy. Nobody acted any differently toward me. The minute I left the hospital, though, was when I realized I was truly in the real world, because as I went downstairs, I immediately noticed in the waiting room kids pointing at me, kids giggling at me. I remember a woman walking by, and her jaw just dropped in shock at the sight of me. And all this stuff happened in literally what seemed like only a few minutes. And that's when I began to realize, wow, this is a pretty serious situation here. Now, for me, though, I could quickly kind of put that behind me, because my doctor, my oncologist, was somebody who never expressed doubt that he would lick the cancer. He never expressed doubt that he would help get me reconstructed back to the old Terry Healy. And so I really believe that, Celeste. I mean, I thought that there was no reason to believe I wasn't going to get reconstructed. You know, I had seen stories and heard stories about people who had horrific things happen and saw the outcomes, and they looked pretty normal. So I think what sustained me through it was having an incredibly positive and optimistic medical team, as well as family and friends and support like that. Just being around positive people and trying not to let those negative encounters and experiences become something that damaged my psyche. Now, ultimately, it did. But as I was saying earlier, it kind of takes day-to-day events, and those things multiply over time. But I would say that I was fortunate to be able to balance those negative experiences with the thought in my head that I'm going to be okay. I'm going to get through this, and I'm going to be back to who I was.
Yeah. I want to mention this for the benefit of the audience, because we're talking on radio today. We can't see you. But included with the book that you sent us is an article from a newspaper featuring several photographs of you. And there's one where the backdrop is a hilly landscape, which I assume is California.
Uh-huh.
And I want to say it's a great picture, and there is a happy, confident man smiling out at the world. And beautiful eyes, Terry.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And there's photographs in the book as well that show the before and after, which is kind of interesting to see.
Yeah. I do like that picture of you in California, though.
It's a meaningful picture to me, and it was very fortunate that the journalist asked me. She wanted to do a photo shoot, and she said, "Well, I can just come by your house." And I said, "Well, that's fine, but if we're going to meet somewhere, you know, how about somewhere more meaningful?" And so she said, "Well, was there anywhere that you used to go during this process to reflect or to think or to help yourself, to calm yourself, to get away from it or whatever?" And I thought, yeah, there was. And that's this area that the photograph was taken. It's a regional park area that I used to go. And for those reasons, I went there to sort of escape from the world. But it was also a time for me to really concentrate and focus and think about myself and what I was going to do. You know, I wasn't going to allow myself to sink, but I needed to kind of be by myself and think through how was I going to approach life and what were the things that I needed to do. So it was a very good time for me to spend all that time alone, which I wasn't used to doing, but it was helpful.
Terry Healy is our guest this afternoon. He's a cancer survivor. He's written a book about his experiences battling cancer. At Face Value is the title of the book. At Face Value, My Struggle with a Disfiguring Cancer. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222. 9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I realize that the thrust of today's program is going to be how people react to people who have had disfiguring operations, and I know that's a very important topic, but I just couldn't resist picking up on the first thing that you have discussed, namely how long it took to realize that something was going a little wrong. I teach a bit at the medical school here, and one of the things we emphasize to our doctors is to try to get male patients to do a monthly testicular self-exam. But the interesting question comes up, if it's such a good idea to do it monthly, why not do it weekly? And the story that Terry's just told illustrates exactly why breast exams and testicular exam have to be monthly. Namely, a thing that changes very, very slowly, we adjust to. And it takes either purposely not looking for a period of time so that you really see there's a change, or you're dependent on people outside you who look at you and say, as they did when you were very small, oh, how Terry grew since I last saw him. Of course, your family's unaware of that because growing takes place every day. Actually, it turns out even growing doesn't take place slowly. I remember going away for a weekend and coming back and seeing my little children, realizing that they had a completely different shaped face from the one that I saw on Friday. There's now medical evidence that, in fact, growth does come in spurts. But even that isn't seen by people who are with you all of the time. So the deep lesson in finding things early here is listen to people who say you look a little different. Or if you're doing things like testicular exam and breast exam, don't do them too frequently. And when you notice a difference, take it seriously. Couldn't resist. Sorry.
Oh, I think that's I'm glad you called in and shared those insights, Terry.
Yeah, and I think that's great, and I appreciate that call as well because, some people, criticize people for being hypochondriacs or for going to the doctor for everything. And, you know, I'm a classic case of, thank God that I did go as early as I did because it would have been easy for me not to. I didn't have any pain. I didn't have any side effects to this. There was nothing, I went to a dentist who said it was a cyst. I mean, nobody seemed very concerned, so I could have just as easily ignored it. But, I would say that that you have to, think through these things, but don't hesitate to ever go to a doctor when you think something might be wrong, because things can happen very quickly as well. So,
Okay. Let's talk with another listener on line 4 in Chicago. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I find this program very interesting. I think it just goes to show you that if you feel that something is wrong, if you have a number of days where you're not feeling good, maybe you should go get a checkup because it's your body's way of saying there's something that isn't right and you shouldn't just ignore it. But I was curious, I remember you saying that the children laughed at you and one woman made her jaw drop. I was curious, did this experience make you more sensitive toward people with disabilities, for instance?
Absolutely. One of the positive outcomes for me is that it really changed my outlook on life. And I think that's really the key message in my book is that, we all need to be less judgmental. We shouldn't judge a book by its cover. And I can't say that as a child I didn't look at people and I didn't laugh at people or point at people. I'm sure I did.
We all do that, but I'm just saying that as you get older, you should grow up. But there's still people who feel uncomfortable if they see someone in a wheelchair or someone who's blind or someone who's deaf or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if your experience made you more sensitive or sensitized you to that.
It definitely did. I would say that it's changed my viewpoints on a lot of things in terms of how I treat other people, how much more sensitive I am to other people. Because I think some people, including myself, become insecure because of their disability or because of their disfigurement or whatever it is, because of their weight. It can be anything that makes you feel insecure. And I think it's really important to be able to approach people in a positive way. I mean, you can't just walk up to somebody randomly and start talking to them, but try to find a way when you see somebody that doesn't look real happy. It's pretty easy to identify. And if you can find a way to just make a nice comment, that can make somebody's day. I mean, I can tell you that people that had positive things to say to me had a tremendous impact on me. And those people came and went. You know, I don't know who they are. I may have spent 4 minutes with them in my life, but it's amazing what our day-to-day encounters, what kind of an impact those things can have. So, you know, you also don't want to noticeably go up to somebody that's different to approach them in any way. You don't want them in any way to feel like they are more noticeable. But I'm definitely more sensitive to it. I think most people actually with disabilities have a lot to offer because they've got a different perspective on life. They've encountered adversity. And I think, you know, as we all know, adversity is actually something that creates opportunity for all of us and makes us look at life differently. And
well,
I wouldn't change anything.
I myself am visually impaired, so that's why I wondered if you had noticed yourself changing in terms of being more sensitive, because once I was a dark room technician, and I once went to a place, and they said, well, we'd like to hire you, but if I do, the boss will fire me. So I just wondered if your own experience, you know, I guess it's true, you never know what a man's like until you've lived his experience.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks
for the call this afternoon. Well, that leads to an interesting question, Terry. Have you faced discrimination in employment situations?
You know, honestly, I can't say I have, and I did worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at one point I felt like, you know, maybe I was being discriminated against. This was shortly after the major surgery where I was left very disfigured, and I was a senior in college, and so I went through the on-campus interview, and I felt like I did real well in the interview, and you know, I didn't get a call back, and I felt like the person was very cold to me. And I actually thought about it. I thought, God, I wonder if this is just an easy way out for them to get rid of me, because they don't know what's really wrong with me. Am I somebody that's sick? Am I somebody that's going to be a liability? But quite honestly, you know, that was easy for me to dish off after time and realize that, you know, any number of things could have happened in that interview, and I'm sure I was far from perfect. But really, I have not felt like I've encountered discrimination in the workplace. Never felt, and I guess as I began to work professionally and the way I presented myself, I became more and more confident over time, and my confidence was rebuilt to a point where, you know, I just stopped thinking about it. So I never thought to mention it, and I would know somebody for a year, for example, before the topic would even come up.
Mm.
And, you know, that told me a lot about myself, is that, you know, it is how you perceive yourself. And that really does affect how other people notice you. And if you don't act like it's a problem and you don't make a point to point it out, I think people just assume that it's not as big of a deal and that it's not an impairment in any way to how you live or how you think or how you work or anything else. So I felt very fortunate. I don't think I ever saw discrimination that way.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Stell on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm so sorry that you had this experience, but I'm sure it's been very educational, as you've said. I wondered if it ever occurred to you to seek any sort of alternative method of dealing with this.
Yes, I would say I did. There was a point in my life, and if I can just quickly give you the background for this, it would probably help. I was seeing one of the best nasal reconstructive surgeons in the world in Chicago. For reconstruction. And what was difficult about it was that I ended up with many new scars in the process of reconstruction. To fix my nose, they borrowed tissue from my forehead. To fix my lip, they borrowed more tissue from my cheek. So I ended up with a lot of new scars. Ultimately, I woke up and I looked in the mirror and I thought, God, I'm taking two steps back for every step forward. I've been doing this reconstruction now for 6 years. And I suddenly realized that I was never going to get back to who I was as the old Terry Healy. So what was I going to do? And I actually sunk to probably a new low at that point. But I was very fortunate to meet somebody in that same hospital, this woman who was being treated in the hospital there. She was from Northwestern, and she and I ended up having a relationship after that that became very intimate. And it was, I say that only because it was the first intimate relationship I'd had with somebody who didn't know me as the old Terry Healy. So that was kind of significant. But the point I'm trying to get to is that we ended up, things didn't really work out for us because she said, you know, I had a lot of issues that she couldn't deal with, and it was really that I needed so much reassurance. The scars on the inside were far more disfiguring than the scars ever were on the outside. And so that opened up this whole world to me that I have to figure out a new way to deal with this, something I've never thought of before. So there are two things that happened. One, I began looking for psychosocial support. I started trying to find group support. That was very beneficial for me. But on a personal level, you know, I found some tools, visualization, to be very, very helpful for me in terms of calming me, in terms of instilling confidence in myself. I would just visualize different types of things. And it's almost like goal setting or setting objectives. It's like if you think about something enough, it can happen. And so I would do a lot of visualization, and I think that really helped me get through some tough moments. And if nothing else, it would always calm me if I was upset. You know?
Yes. Well, my thought, what I had in mind when I asked that was alternative means of healing so that you wouldn't have to go through that disfigurement. There are many ways of healing cancer, but of course...
Oh, I see where you're going. Okay.
This is hardly ever allowed to come to the surface in public intercourse like this because of the dominance of the American Medical Association, but California is full of such places, and there might be, there could still be value for you in seeking some of those to be sure that this doesn't encroach on your health again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, California is full of them. And if I could speak with you privately, I could give you some ideas. But I don't think your life is over, and I think alternative methods could contribute to you if you could allow it.
Well, first of all, so I am very content now with who I am, and it doesn't bother me that I look different. In fact, you know, I'm very comfortable with everything about myself, and I think as things evolve, I haven't really showed an interest in pursuing you know, different ways on the Western medicine side to try to fix my appearance. So are you talking about more? I'm not sure I understand how my disfigurement could affect other aspects of my health.
Well, the caller isn't with us at the
okay.
moment. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you, which I think was hinted at in the caller's question and comment, Terry, do you think without that surgery you'd be alive today?
No, I don't.
Yeah. And it seems to me that you've taken sort of the best that East and West have to offer in terms of you've worked on the visualization technique and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The mind-body connection. But at the same time, it seems pretty clear that without that surgery, you wouldn't be with us.
No, I absolutely agree, and I think you're right. It's a balance. I think balance is always good, and in my case, I think the balance was very important. I definitely feel like had I not had that surgery, that there would be no way I'd be here today. I think it was just growing so aggressively. But Western medicine can't do everything for us, and a lot of people's ability to heal, recover, their return to wellness has a lot to do with attitude and other forms, potentially other forms of healing that you need to go through that the medical community can't necessarily give you. Because it's sort of counter to what they do. Mm. So it's kind of the patient's responsibility to find ways to keep, to maintain hope and to find ways to kind of treat their psyche through the whole process.
How much did you know about the cancer in the course of treatment at the outset? And, you know, were you a hands-on kind of patient, what we call an active patient?
In what terms exactly do you mean?
Were you involved in researching the cancer? Were you in terms of discussing your illness, your cancer with, and your care and treatment with your doctor and doctors?
You know, it's interesting because I think the way I am today is different than the way I was then. At that point, being 20, 21 years old, this was a whole new world to me. I didn't really know how to go about research this. To me, cancer was cancer, and the type of cancer I had, sarcoma and the subset of that, fibrosarcoma, didn't mean that much to me. And this was sort of before the advent of the internet, so information wasn't as readily available. I could have easily gone and researched it. I think my big fear, though, Celeste, was I almost didn't want to know. I almost wanted to be somewhat ignorant because the last thing I wanted to ever hear was statistics. You know, we've got a 50% chance of beating this cancer or something like that, because I think that to me would have been something very hard to live with. My doctor was one of these guys that never gave me statistics. He said, you know, we're going to treat this thing, and together we're going to beat this thing, Terry, and this is treatable. And that was almost all I needed to hear. I had so much confidence in him. I had confidence in UCSF. I mean, it's a great medical institution. I really relied a lot on that, and I wasn't that active in the research process. There was a lot of trust, and in a lot of ways I was very lucky, because I wouldn't necessarily recommend that today to somebody. I wouldn't say just trust your doctor, because we all know they're human and they make mistakes, and there are so many types of specialists that are out there today, and there's so much more information that's out there today that it probably does pay to be educated. The fact that I was somewhat ignorant was probably a blessing at the time. I didn't have to worry about all of those things that could happen and where it could spread, and the likelihood that I would heal from this, and the likelihood that I would be cancer-free in 5 years or 10 years. So that's kind of how I dealt with it then.
I would imagine, just as everyone is different in terms of how we become ill and how we become well, so too in between, for some of us, we're going to want to know everything, and others of us will want to know some, but please, that's enough. And probably for some folks, it's just too much.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the main messages, because I talk to cancer patients a lot, is I always ask them when they're going through treatment, do you like your doctor? What do you think about your doctor? And it's really disheartening, because I would say close to half the people, when they really say, honestly, Terry, they'll say, you know, I got this issue with them, or I don't really like them, but I don't know what to do about it. And there's not much I can say, unfortunately, because I can't tell them, well, leave your medical provider, because people don't have that many choices sometimes. So I won't name names, but if your provider is XYZ and they have a reputation for not being that great, you don't happen to like your doctor, that's a difficult spot to be in. But at least maybe there's other doctors within that network that you could talk to. And I think that having hope and confidence is so critical. I mean, if you don't have that with your doctor, you need to find it. I think it has a huge impact on your ability to get through it.
You're active in a support community called the Wellness Community.
Yes.
Would you like to tell us about the Wellness Community?
The Wellness Community is a nonprofit dedicated to providing support services for cancer patients and their families. They are based out of Philadelphia, and they've got about 20 locations throughout the United States, and then they've got some overseas. Basically, what they provide is a forum for people, a comfortable forum for people to talk amongst cancer patients either diverse types of cancer and not gender-specific, or they can be gender-specific and cancer-specific. So they've kind of given you these types of choices. But what's also really unique about it is that support people can go there and go to support person groups. So in other words, if your spouse is suffering from cancer, he can go to a group, and more than likely you can go to a group that meets at the same time and talk to other caregivers about what are the issues being faced. And I thought that was pretty a pretty neat concept, because for me, I found it was very easy to be selfish and focused on myself and take care of myself, but because I was sick, and I could be that way, I felt, but at the expense of other people. And so I think the support people don't always know what to do. They don't know what to say. They don't know how much they should care and how much they should let go and how much space to give people. And so I think, you know, that's a really neat thing that they offer. But they have different workshops and groups and resources, and they try to make it a very comfortable environment. So it's not like a medical setting, but it's more like a house. Mm-hmm. So that you feel comfortable and you can come and go whenever you want. So it was very helpful for me. It was a big turning point for me to get involved there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I've kind of stuck through it. And first as a participant and then as a volunteer, kind of helping people. And then more recently, the last couple of years, as a board member, trying to help grow the organization.
Yeah. I looked it up on the web. It looks like a pretty neat organization, and there are chapters in the Metro East area of St. Louis, or in the St. Louis metropolitan area, I guess I should say, and in Indianapolis as well.
Mm-hmm.
For some time, you withdrew. You were doing some hiding out, really. How did you get that turned around? And maybe you'd talk with us about the therapeutic value of reaching out to others and, for example, doing work with the wellness community.
Yeah, it was really hard for me to continue to go out to bars and do the stuff that you do when you're 22 years old. It was very difficult because I was constantly feeling like people weren't treating me or wanting to talk to me. New people, you know, you meet a lot of new people in these kind of environments. I didn't want to go to parties. So, yeah, I definitely withdrew. And I think that some of the key turning points for me, the one I mentioned earlier about the girl I met, opened me up to, you know, it's not the physical appearance, Terry. You know, I mean, that's not the problem. It's your inner self. It's your person.
Mm-hmm.
That you have to deal with. And so I think going to the wellness community and finding that telling my story, people saw me as this, outsiders saw me actually as very confident, and they thought that it was amazing what I had been through. I had so much to be proud of. And I think what was really compelling was that they suddenly felt like their concerns about losing their hair from chemo or gaining weight or losing weight from the chemo paled in comparison to what really mattered, living your life and appreciating life for what it is and what you have. So those kind of things, I think, really made me feel like, you know, if I can be inspirational to other people, then, you know, hiding out is not the answer. I should be proud of what I've been through, and I should be able to walk in public and feel good about myself. And, you know, it's interesting, Celeste, somebody asked me the other day, you know, has launching this book or getting this book completed changed you in any way? And, mm-hmm. and I would say that this has been another stepping stone in terms of liberating me and making me a lot more comfortable and not wanting to, hide. I had a lot of scarring on my chest related to some of the reconstruction where they borrowed a lot of tissue from my shoulder, and that was a source of insecurity for me. But once I got this book out, mm-hmm. it was funny. It was this summer, so without even thinking about it, I went out on the trail and started running without my shirt on. And I was like 4 minutes into the run, and I thought, oh, my God, you know, I would never have done this before. Why am I doing this? And suddenly it was like I was almost proud of it. It's like, I want the world to see this. You know, people are different, but it doesn't mean that we're any different, really. We're still people. W. Mitchell, I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's kind of an inspirational speaker. I mean, he's had all kinds of things happen to him. And he says, you know, I used to be able to do 10,000 things. Yeah, now I can do 9,000. He's in a wheelchair now. But, I mean, he just has this incredible way of looking at things, and we're still the same people, really. You know, it doesn't change us that much, but I feel proud of it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's such a great message. You know, we all know that old saw, beauty is only skin deep, but, you know, a lot of us live there. There's so much emphasis on appearance,
mm-hmm.
and we place so much emphasis on appearance that it can lead to us harming ourselves. If you think about, you know, eating disorders,
absolutely.
For example.
It was funny. I was giving a book reading last night, and they had my podium up against the magazine section. So I was sitting here starting my discussion, and I looked behind me, and here's this entire row of women's magazines, and, you know, every one of them had a beautiful model on the cover of it. And it's like, you know, this is what our society is interested in. This is what our society, unfortunately, is so much based upon. This is what we see every day. So, I mean, it's kind of an interesting dichotomy, I guess.
Yeah. We're almost out of time. Before we go, I do want to ask you this question. What advice do you have for family and friends of someone who's facing a serious illness?
Who's facing any kind of serious illness?
Yeah.
Don't ever underestimate your ability to impact somebody, and don't deal with it. You sort of have to take action and try to be part of what this person's going through. I think everybody approaches that in a different way, but just trying to be there for people is incredibly powerful. Whether you get that feedback or not, at some point you may or you may not. But I think that knowing that you have support, knowing that you have people that you can lean on, has an incredible impact on a patient encountering any kind of serious situation. I would encourage people to do differently than what I did at that point, which is to do the research and make sure that you are going to the best and the brightest, and that you have confidence, because I think that confidence is key to your recovery. I think also, it's great to find other people to talk to that are independent of your family and friends, people that are more objective, people that can relate to what you're going through. So I think going to a support group or even talking to a counselor. You know, I always thought that going to a psychologist was a bad thing. It meant that there was something terribly wrong with you, you know.
Mm.
I found that talking to people, objective people, is incredibly helpful. Because you don't get objective feedback from people that are very close to you. So you get different things from different types of people. And use those resources. I don't want to say use them in the wrong sense. Don't use people, but I mean embrace all those things. But also, I would say, you know, I don't know if this is great advice for everybody, but I would say make sure that you have a purpose beyond your situation, your illness, because I think without another purpose, you tend to dwell on it, and I've been there. It's not healthy. You need to have another purpose, and I think another purpose can be something that gives you goals and objectives. It gives you something to strive for, which makes you sort of aspire to something, which sort of having goals out there is something that we all look forward to, and anticipation, I think, is one of the greatest things in life. So if you can think about future things that you want to do or want to achieve, I think those are powerful things to help you get through any ordeal.
Yeah, kind of the business of life, right?
Yeah.
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 I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon, Terry.
Thank you very much for having me on your show, Celeste.
Take care. Terry Healy has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His book is At Face Value, My Struggle with a Disfiguring Cancer.